So you've just finished a one-week retreat. Today was the Thanksgiving retreat that we had before Thanksgiving. And it's quite delightful hearing a diverse group of Ajahns. I think we had a spread from Tenvasa Ajahn, an Ajahn who's been a monk for 10 years, all the way to 49 years, I think, for Lumpur. So, yeah, it was lovely to share the space with monks. Lumpur and Ajahn Kirudam were in England at Amaravati Monastery, so nice with the Zoom technology, having that capacity. And tonight's a bit of a special night for me. I have my sister visiting, and Rabbi Mintz. People sometimes ask, oh, wow, you have a rabbi for a sister. So what's that like? And I've never answered this way, but it's like this. So, yeah, it's actually for me, it's a unique relationship to have. Being leaders, teachers in different religious communities. And it's quite delightful. She's staying overnight tonight. But I think this is the first Dhamma talk, at least you'll hear, in the monastery. I'll refer to her from now on as Sydney. That's how I know her, and she knows me as Chunda. Sydney's also invited me to give talks and lead meditations to some of her congregants. And I was reflecting about that, you know, that the familial sense that we have during the winter retreat. During this Thanksgiving retreat, you know, there's questions people often have about their relationships, especially to their family members or closest family members, and just reflecting on the comma of that and how much these relationships are quite meaningful to us. Sometimes we can have challenging relationships, sometimes very deep and rewarding relationships with our family members. I think for most people, though, they're often filled with a certain amount of dukkha, a certain amount of joy and pleasure. And it's just, you know, it's just very normal. And yet those questions can come out. What do I do about my brother, or my relationship with my father, or my mother, whatever it might be? And the Buddha talked about the relationship one has with one's mother and father as being incredibly special. It's not a random chance that the Buddha says we are born to our parents. In fact, he brings this up as part of right view. So in order to have right view, you have the belief and understanding that there is mother, there's father, meaning that your mother and father, and therefore it would also seem that it's your sisters and brothers, these are comically potent relationships. And so sometimes they can be, they can have that feeling of being very influential on one's heart, one's mind. So I feel very lucky in my family to, even though we're, when we get together, it's usually the whoever has the loudest voice wins. But we're a very close family, and that's very, it feels very good whenever we're together. And so this evening, my sister was relating to me the how we also have seem to have a comic relationship to my mother and her cooking, especially her cookies. And that was a quite a funny comic. So I thought, oh, that's actually true. This past visit, my mom came, and every morning she offered me cookies, and I brought them for breakfast to the monks and to the lady, and I was thinking about that, like, oh, has that changed for me as a monk? And then I kind of thought more in the different trajectory of just the movement of the mind towards what one can get excited about or be very interested in, and how that takes a lot of meaning for us, and we can sort of make much out of things that are pleasurable to us, that are interesting. And it's kind of the things that are, you know, they're more difficult to bear with, that we have trouble dealing with. So, you know, this is related to one of the lines in the suttas of, I think it's in the recitation we do in English with the Dhammacakka Sutta. It's ever seeking fresh delight. Now here, now there. I hope I got the right sutta on that one. And just thinking about the mind in that way, thinking about how there's almost just an inevitable experience where we're seeking some sort of pleasure or different experience or some sort of interest we have each day. And each moment, actually, the mind can kind of move in this direction. And how funny it can be, just because it doesn't, you know, just having your particular mother's cookie, and how comforting that is, or whatever it might be for you. You know, however, whatever that means. And yet the mind is drawn out. We can be practitioners for very long periods of time, and we still fall for this over and over again. Something sort of exciting or interesting. I was thinking how Ajahn Yanako, every few Dhamma talks, he'll make some humorous mention of the fact that we have one day a week where bread is served. And sometimes he'll say, oh yeah, if you oversleep on this day, then very serious suffering can occur, or you, whatever might happen, you miss something. And it's just like that. Like, I never thought when I was, before I became a monk, like I would get really excited about something like bread, or interested. And, you know, it's not like I like had a roommate and I was making myself a bowl of oatmeal and had some, you know, just added a couple of things to it, and then he pulled out some bread, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. You're eating bread. That's so amazing. And yet you become a monk, and then there it is, ever seeking fresh delight, just something different, something to chew on that we find of interest or exciting. And I've often pondered about that, how something like food, something that I was talking about a little bit about a week ago with the four nutriments, that food is one of the four nutriments, craving. And that's what our mind kind of clings to and thinks and makes much about. But when I relate to it, when I actually relate to my connection to food or what it is, I can see very clearly that when I'm eating it, it's just not as exciting as the thought about it or the interest I have in it. Even sometimes I can honestly say, like, this isn't something that's that enjoyable. It's just that I've created some sort of interest in it and excitement. And so we keep kind of falling for this. And I was thinking about Arlo, who is my nephew is here, and he was coming into the room, he was going to meditate, and I had kind of thought I would give a guided meditation, and I just mentioned it, but then I forgot to mention it to Ajahn Sudhiro, the audio monk, and Ajahn Kasapo. So I thought, it's not going to work out. And then, you know, there's a sense of, okay, what's that like in the mind of a 12-year-old to sit here, doesn't have any instruction? Maybe he's meditated a couple of times in his life, but there's not much there. So what does an untrained mind do? How much agony might there be just sitting through 15 minutes and then, you know, needing to get up, go out, do something else, stretch, find a book, whatever it might be, other than being with boredom or experiencing non-activity, not being able to find something fresh or delightful. And so it's a very good encouragement for us to ask ourselves about that, because more and more each day we're being challenged. By our experience, we're being challenged and encouraged to not have to examine difficult mind states or boredom or challenges we have with people. We just need to escape into our screens. And it's just very very easy. Even if it's not a screen, it's like each one of us, we have our poison. We have those things that we go to that aren't necessarily very helpful for us. And so we can ask ourselves, you know, what is it about this sort of boredom or this mind that's seeking delight in any given moment? What is it that is so painful, you know, not being able to have sense pleasure? And the basics around this teaching is that we're seeking the wrong pleasure. It's as the Buddha talked about with nutriment. It's that we're gnawing on something, we're chewing on something, like a dog, he says, chewing on a bone. And there's nothing there, just its own saliva, you know, intermixing with the bone. It's not getting anything, but yet it's obsessed with continuing to chew on this bone. And that's, you know, that's often just what it's like for us. So Sydney was talking to me about, we were comparing notes on Dhamma talks, and I was saying, yeah, maybe tonight I'll give a Dhamma talk. I was preparing her, they're usually about 40, 45 minutes. And she said, oh, well, mine are, the last one I gave was about 10, 11 minutes. I said, oh, really? Just 10 or 11 minutes? She said, yep. And when I give a 10-minute talk, people come up to me and they say, that was an amazing talk. I'm so interested. I'm so eager to just come back next week and hear you again. I'm really excited. I can't wait. And if she gives a 15-minute talk, then same thing happens. I come back, so I can't wait to come back and hear you again. But then it's 20 minutes. Those comments start to drop off. People don't come up and they're not so interested anymore. 20 minutes, which is sad because maybe at the 20-minute mark, that's when something sort of perhaps profound and interesting might have been said. So we have these short attention spans. We have difficulty with patience, with seeing sometimes that there might be a benefit with waiting it out, or just being present with our own boredom. I was thinking, you know, my sister is visiting and she has her dog with her now, and it's 14, so it's at the end part of her life. Her name's Ivy. So she's healthy in body, but she's lost all her short-term memory, and possibly a lot of long-term memory. And so it's interesting to watch her, because she kind of recognizes my sister, but she doesn't really know what's going on. She can't see so well or hear so well. And she can kind of get excited sometimes and move about, but as my sister said, she just forgets that she's a dog sometimes. She doesn't really know what's going on, except when there's food. And then she remembers she's a dog, and these other senses don't come back, but her smell is there, and that's it for her. She can just find food in the room. She knows people are having food. She gets very excited. She can remember how to tell people it's time to feed me. So this is nose consciousness. This is how we are attracted to things. And it's a great metaphor, because you think like, oh, the other senses are dulled, they're gone, they're not there. It's not even memory. The mental functioning isn't quite there. But yet, the nose is, and the nose knows. And so we can be just like dogs sometimes in that way, just leading into a sense perception, leading into that nutriment, becoming obsessed with it, interested in it. And it's just a smell. And to a dog like Ivy, who, yeah, there's not much memory going on anymore. Again, the other senses have faded. And just this conditioning around pleasure and food becomes present. This conditioning around a smell. And so we have the opportunity through the Buddhist teachings, in terms of like really exploring that, like what's this about? What is this interest that we have? And are we actually falling for something? What does that mean? Like, as the Buddha talks about, he calls it like a hook and bait. And we see that there's pleasure there, but eventually we can see the hook, you know? Because mostly we're just focused on the bait, we're focused on the pleasure. But eventually we see the hook and it's, oh, there's danger there. There's danger when I'm obsessed with something. There's danger when I'm interested in this one thing. And when we recognize that danger, then as the Buddha's talking about with wisdom, then we have an escape. We're able to escape from that. That experience, we're able to escape from our seeking of delight. And so for, you know, I think when I was relating to Arlo and his experience of meditation, I was thinking, yeah, I don't know if he has the interest yet in wanting to escape that. It's not there. The screens are too important sometimes, or the. But then there are experiences. I know the life he's living is quite good. He lives on a houseboat, and so there's a lot of physical activity, and you know, he gets to experience his own body, go out on the water. And we can do the best we can, but we have to take care of ourselves, just like, you know, we're sort of taking care of kids, we're taking care of our own minds. And we have to keep looking after it. We have to keep looking after being fooled over and over again, that it's in the pleasures we're seeking. And so what we're gaining, and what came up in the retreat a lot, is it reminds me of the when someone asked Lumbar Pasno at a retreat one time, you know, like, how do monks have fun? And as Ajahn Yanako told that story, he said that Lumbar was laughing for a couple of minutes. And I think he said his response was, oh, it's not fun. What we're doing isn't fun. And yet, as the Buddha teaches, it leads to the highest happiness. And that doesn't really make sense in a worldly way. Like, how can something that's not fun lead to happiness? And so for those of us who've been practicing a while, we see, oh yeah, okay. If I deal with my experience, if I get to know something like boredom, I get to know what it feels like to be bored, then slowly but surely that very awareness of that boredom begins to become unstuck. So we get to see the difference between the awareness of that boredom and the boredom itself. And that's how a Buddhist has fun. That's how we find pleasure. Because when that occurs, then there is this very very special experience, and an experience that gives us a lot of confidence in our own understanding of our experience. It allows us to see, right, oh, okay, there's an alternative. There is an escape from that pleasure-seeking mind. And when we have that, then that does bring a lot of pleasure, because we say, oh, I don't have to necessarily give in to the drive that I have for this worldly pleasure. It's hard to see if no one's ever pointed it out to us. It's hard to kind of get on our own without understanding that. But it's really useful because it leads us to Nibbana. It leads us to the end of suffering. And so the irony around the life of a practitioner not necessarily being fun, not being entertaining, it's not like looking at a screen, because it's challenging. It's the most difficult thing that could be done. But when we get that, then we do gain that pleasure, that confidence, that understanding, and the suffering becomes less and less. So it's revealed as a true inner happiness, an experience of contentment. And what I find for myself that's been difficult is the draw to this pleasure-seeking mind that is such a hard habit to break. And it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of patience, And sometimes it takes a lot of lifetimes. So we can get frustrated sometimes and think, oh, you know, I wish that this would, you know, take a lot less time, a lot less effort. I wish it wasn't so painful. But this is the cards we're dealt with. This is what we have. I remember one very senior Thai monk said to me that when he was regarding his own practice, I was asking him about his practice, and I said, wow, it just seems to have come so easily for you. And he said, you don't know how many lifetimes I've been doing this. You know, you have to just take with your own life what you have. You can't look to how another person's done it and think it's going to be the same for me. And also for ourselves, you know, it's hard to look at our own experience and see whether we can really judge it in a way to say, like, oh, I don't have that kind of past life barami, I don't have the all this goodness that other monks who've had seem to have had an easier time or quicker understanding. Because it's only after we practice quite diligently and put a lot of effort into it that parami, that sense of how our past is really influencing our connection to understanding the Dhamma, we can't really see it until there's often been a lot of practice. At least that's how it's been described to me, and it makes a lot of sense. Mind's very confused at first. It's interesting because talking more specifically about the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha has these four stages of enlightenment. And you know, it's like there's like a stream enter, that's the first stage. And a once returner and non-returner, and then somebody who's fully enlightened. But as I understand it, you know, if one becomes a stream enter and then you're reborn again as a human being, it's not like, you know, you come out of your mother's womb. And I'm a stream enter. You know, I'm ready for the next stage. So it takes a lot of development on the path. To see one's own potential, and so we shouldn't kind of we have to be careful with the difficulties we encounter, and we have to know that it's important for us to keep going, no matter how difficult things get or how painful they are. We keep encouraging ourselves, and we measure. You know, we can ask ourselves, well, I've been practicing for a while. Like, if my mind is telling me that I've gotten nothing out of it, really, you have to ask yourself, is that true? There's no understanding that's been gained. There's no more patience. There's nothing that's occurred. And I think we need to be honest with ourselves. Ajahn Kaspa was encouraging one of the people who had asked a question on the retreat, who was talking about their focus on their negative traits or difficulties. And she said, well, you know, why do you want to focus on those? You know, try to look at the good things that you've done and really kind of bring those up in your mind. Because otherwise, you're just going to be mired in dukkha. It's not really helpful. It's not beneficial. So we can do that. We can kind of remind ourselves, and it's important that we do, because that the habit of our minds can be, you know, we might be seeking pleasure and delight, but at the same time we can torture ourselves with our own inadequacies. And so it's helpful to really look at those and and question ourselves about our own beliefs, what we think. Because even, you know, even in the seeking of pleasure, we can sometimes find pleasure in that torturing, that kind of habitual sense of judging ourselves or misunderstanding how it is that we really are. Because it creates a sense of me, creates solidity. And that's more, in a way, although it quite can be negative, it is still a pleasure seeking. I know I'm like this, this is who I am, and we keep creating that over and over again. So this is just an encouragement to keep our eyes on the Dhamma, to keep pointing towards the Dhamma, and looking carefully at how we are interested in some things that are not so beneficial for us, and to try to be honest with that, those interests that we have, again, it's not a means by which we can say, oh, see, there I am, I'm just such a terrible person, because I just love my mom's cookies. That's not beneficial at all. But just as an acknowledgement, and say, oh, right, this is how pleasure works. And maybe instead of eating this cookie, so I can gain, a spike in this sensual experience that I want to have, I can remember, oh, right. And when my mom made this cookie, she worked on it. She put a lot of love into it. And that can be something that I can enjoy. That can be a pleasure that I can really bring up in the mind. And that's wholesome. That's a wholesome movement of mind. So we begin to recognize that and we find ways that we can bring that up for ourselves. So for all of you who have moms out there who are still making you cookies, I hope you can still rejoice in that. For others of you who have those as memories, then you can remember that kindness and love. And if it's banana bread like Ajahn Tee Tapanyo's mom, you can be happy for her giving as well, whatever it might be. But yeah, just an encouragement to really look at the sense of the bait and the hook and the potential for us to rise above it all and find our own confidence and happiness within the practice. Well.